Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Sports Takeover with Matt and Chris, and you are listening to RMU Radio. Before we get started, the sports world and society as a whole lost an incredible person, as Kobe Bryant was one of nine individuals that lost their lives in a helicopter crash this past weekend. Chris, I don't think you can say enough about Kobe Bryant. Obviously, all nine lives that were lost are equally important, but Kobe Bryant was a different type of person.
There was two people to him. It was Kobe Bryant, the basketball player, Kobe Bryant, the person. I'll start with the basketball player part first because he was incredible for the NBA world, a top five player of all time. People talk about him being the best with Jordan and LeBron, and it's hard to say who is the best, but there's no doubt all the achievements he has on the court. Five-time NBA champion, played 20 years in the whole league, so about a quarter of the time he played, he won a championship, all 20 years with the Lakers, two-time finals MVP, one-time regular season MVP, 18-time All-Star, only two seasons didn't get thrown in the game, four-time All-Star Game MVP, and then a lot more accolades that it's going to run down real fast, 11-time NBA All-First Team, two-time Second Team, two-time Third Team, very good defensively as well, nine-time First Team, three-time Second Team, was the scoring leader two times in his career, two gold medals too with Team USA on the Redeem Team in 08, and then in 2012 once again. He was third in all-time points until this past Saturday, actually, when LeBron James passed him, so he's fourth now in all-time points, but a lot of great accolades on the court, brought a lot of success to the city of Los Angeles, really the face of the Lakers.
Yeah, he was 41 years old when he passed away this Sunday. He had four daughters. Gianna, his 13-year-old daughter, unfortunately was on the helicopter with him when it crashed. So he leaves behind three daughters and his wife, Vanessa. You talked about everything that he did during his playing career. He did incredible things after his playing career, too. He won an Oscar in 2018 for Dear Basketball, which won for Best Animated Short Film. He did some producing, some publishing, some podcasting, and keep in mind, he only retired in 2016. So he did a lot of this stuff off the court in a short period of time, began coaching as well. His daughter Gianna, the one that was on the helicopter with him, was, I guess, supposed to be the heir, I guess, to the Bryant basketball legacy. She was,
essentially, yeah,
I guess, a pretty good player. They had a nickname for her. It was Mambacita, playing
that's,
off Kobe Bryant's
nice.
Black
like
Mamba nickname. And apparently there was a trademark out for it, too, that he just put in recently. So they expected big things from her, and unfortunately that's not going to be in the future at this point now. He also, going back to his off-the-court accomplishments, opened Mamba Sports Academy, which actually was where they were flying. That was where Gianna was scheduled to play, and he was scheduled to coach later on Sunday. And again, the things that he did on the court, a tremendous athlete that it's unfathomable that this happened, but just the person that he was larger than life. And I guess in my mind, it was so shocking because he was one of those people that just seemed almost untouchable.
Yeah.
Like you have your celebrities and then you have the next tier up, and Kobe was in that next tier up. And as you know, the days have gone by, there have been plenty of people who obviously knew him well that have spoken on different things. And there were two that I saw that stuck with me. One was Ice Cube, rapper and actor, who appeared on ESPN and said that he texted Kobe's phone after hearing about what had happened because he couldn't grasp the fact that he was gone, and he sent him a text to see if he would reply. And obviously when there was no reply, he began to worry. But it's interesting that, you know, I think that just speaks to how difficult it was to believe the news that he went and sent him a text afterwards. And then Monday night, Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show did a tribute to Kobe prior to the show, and a quote from his tribute was, "In my head, I thought that he was going to live forever." And again, that just perfectly sums up, I think, the feeling around Kobe and around people like Kobe. They're just on another level, whether you're looking at them as a person or as an athlete. They're just a tier above, you know, your typical celebrity or your typical basketball player, and that just makes it all the more shocking and all the more devastating.
Yeah, you thought he was going to be a guy that you would just see around the basketball world and even around the city of Los Angeles in general for 40, 50 more years, just doing good things with his family. You know, his daughter probably would have played at college somewhere, maybe gone to the women's team, but obviously he was going to have an impact on his city regardless what he did. I saw Jim Rome had a story on just how what kind of person he was in general. Jim Rome's a radio guy in LA. He's on radio for a number of years. Been on ESPN, now does his own show on CBS or whatever. But there was a time like 10 years, 15 years ago, he used to get his friends together for dinner like once a month in LA. Like they'd all go out for drinks or whatever, then go get a steak. And Jim Rome, you know, invited Kobe one night, and Kobe showed up. And then when they were getting ready to go to the restaurant, he's like, "Oh no, sorry, I gotta, you know, hit the gym." And Jim Rome's like, "It's 9 o'clock on a Friday night in the middle of the summer." He's like, "Yeah, but I missed my workout in the morning. You know, I just gotta go get it." He was always about that go get it mentality, the Mamba mentality, of, if you're more familiar with him, that no matter what, you just got to keep grinding, keep trying, keep doing what you're doing. That's why he wasn't just sitting around. And after he had retired, you know, he had his Mamba Academy. He was coaching his daughter and a bunch of other young people to live on their basketball dreams like he did so long ago and for so long. And for that to be taken away, it's just, it's irreplaceable. There's nothing you can do that you can possibly get back the value he gave to his community and everybody else around him.
Yeah, and here we are 3 days later, and I don't know that it's any easier to believe. I think people are, I mean, you have to accept it obviously at this point, but it's one of those things that just doesn't seem right.
No, it's not. It won't be right. There's no way to make it right. And I think for us, probably it's like the first major like sports star, you know, that we've seen pass away during our lifetimes. I mean, you know, we've seen players have passed away or whatever, but nobody of his magnitude and awesomeness. Like maybe in the 30s when Lou Gehrig passed away, it could be similar, but obviously we can't compare to that. And especially the outreach that people have now with social media. And I mean, a guy played 20 years. Even if you don't know anything about the NBA or basketball, you know the name Kobe Bryant. You know who he is. You know what he means. And that's just the lasting impact and legacy he's going to leave on us now.
Yeah. If you can go by one name, like a Kobe, you're universally known, and that's exactly what he was. So unfortunately, given Sunday's accident, 9 lives were lost, and a Lakers legend is gone at the age of 41.
But certainly not forgotten.
So not really an easy way to transition from that, but there is, of course, more positive news in the sports world. And
great news.
Maybe even good timing, given this accident gives us something to look forward to a little bit more. The Super Bowl is this weekend, and it's kind of been overshadowed a little bit here at the beginning of the week, but it is Super Bowl week. We are going to get headed in that direction now. So Super Bowl 54 this Sunday, 49ers and Chiefs. We kind of talked about it a little bit last week, but we're going to talk about it more in depth now. San Francisco 15-3 on the season. Chiefs are 14-4. We've got a battle between two really different franchises. You've got a Chiefs team that has one Super Bowl to their name and has not played for one in 50 years. You've got a 49ers team that is less than 10 years removed from their most recent Super Bowl appearance, and they have 5 Super Bowls in their franchise's history. So two very different types of teams in terms of their history, two very different types of teams in terms of the way that they play, you know, this year, the 2019 versions of these teams. You've got a Kansas City team that has your last year's MVP in Patrick Mahomes, high-flying offense. Defense is a bit suspect. That's where you're going to find your weaknesses with that team.
Playing decently enough recently, though.
Decent, but certainly still the weakness of that club. On the other side, you've got the 49ers. You've got Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback, who has 2 Super Bowls, was not the starter for either of those, but he's been there. He's seen this moment before, knows kind of what it takes. He's learned from Tom Brady. But that's not where they make their living. They make their living on the defensive side of the football, with just a whole cast of players that have been nothing but fantastic this year for San Francisco. And of course, the running game on the ground by committee, and last game for them, the NFC title game, Raheem Mostert went off. So two very different styles here that we're going to see face off on Sunday.
I'm going to start off with, not about this season, but actually about last season. So the Niners did play the Chiefs last season. It was actually Jimmy G's last game with the Niners before he suffered the injury, missed the rest of the season. It was week 3 of the 2018 season. The Chiefs played at home against the Niners. They won 38-27. So I think we're going to see a similar scoreline to that in this game. Clearly high-powered offense. In that game, Jimmy G, he was all right. 20 for 30, 2 touchdowns, 251 in the air. Not too bad. That was also not the same Niners team that year as it was this year. I would say the Chiefs team between last year and this year, not largely different. You know, some different faces, but all in all, I mean, they're obviously a better version of themselves this year, but if you remember correctly, last year they were only one offsides really away from beating New England and being in the Super Bowl. So
yeah, and you could even make the argument, I think, that the difference between last year and this year is that New England wasn't as good.
Right. Yeah, honestly, the Chiefs essentially were just as good this year as they were last year. Just now they have more experience. That's gotten them here. It's funny, we talk about them having more experience, even though the Niners are the team that most recently made the Super Bowl, but I don't know if there's really any similarities between that 2012 team and this year's team on the Niners.
I would say not. I would say not.
Richard Sherman obviously has plenty of experience, made two Super Bowls with the Seahawks, one victory, obviously, and he kind of is the leader on this defense. I mean, he's really the only big-name guy that's been there for in the league for like more than 6 years. Most of the other guys they have are young, which is no fault of their own. They're very talented. It's just they don't have the experience level. But where the experience does come into play is with Jimmy G. He saw all the process and all the mythology that Tom Brady went through in those two Super Bowls when he sat behind him. He knows what it's like to lead up to that big game. He knows what the quarterback needs to do. He's seen it firsthand. And if there's anybody you want to have experience from before you go in the game, it's Tom Brady. So he certainly has that experience on his side. And the stats also go towards the Niners side a little bit too. I'm going to start on the offensive side. So they're fourth in yards per game. Kansas City's sixth, pretty even. Pass yards per game, the Niners are 13th, Kansas City's fifth, but that makes sense to everybody who watches football. Niners don't pass it a lot. Kansas City pretty much only does. Run game, like you said, is where they do really well with Mostert. Niners are second in rushing. Chiefs are 23rd. And points, the Niners are second and the Chiefs are fifth. So very similar offenses. Basically, the Niners focus on the run, the Chiefs focus on the pass, but both get it done very effectively.
Yeah, like I said, they're just teams that are built very differently. I think the one place where they are similar is at the tight end position, where you have two of the best tight ends in football with Kittle on one side and Kelce on the other side.
Absolutely.
That's probably where they're the most similar. I found a good article by the Washington Post that had a lot of interesting stats, a little bit outside the box. So
I love these interesting ones. So give me some tidbits.
Oh, there's a lot here. So we're going to hit on some and we'll talk about some of them. San Francisco defense. Throughout the regular season and postseason, has allowed 25 yards per drive. That's second in the NFL behind only New England. 25 yards per drive.
So we'll just put it this way. Let's assume San Francisco scores, they kick it off, they get a touchback. You start with the ball at 25. Teams barely make it to midfield.
Yeah, pretty
much.
That's it. Offensively, they have 25 big plays on the year, which is 20-plus yards. 25 is not the correct number. Let me find the right number. I think it's 85. 65 of those are through the air. 23 of them are to Deebo Samuel. So if you're looking for a big play guy here in the Super Bowl, where those are the types of make or break moments, Deebo Samuel is going to be your guy. 85 is the number. 65 of them are passing. So interesting there for an offense that you wouldn't necessarily expect to have a whole lot of big plays. Kittle, I talked about being one of the similarities here at tight end. 3.1 yards per route run for him this year. That's the most in the NFL by any tight end, wide receiver, or running back.
So what does that mean exactly?
Like 3.1 yards gained per route he ran on the year.
Okay. I was thinking like he ran 3 yards of route. And I'm like,
No. So efficiency is the way I look at that one.
Yes, that's it.
One of the most, arguably the most efficient pass catcher in the NFL this year. Mostert, 4.5 yards per carry after contact this postseason. You want to talk about playing at the right time? He's playing well at the right time. Bosa, 6 most quarterback pressures with 80 among edge rushers this season, which I think we would have guessed. I mean, he's been really good this year in his rookie campaign.
Yeah, only in his first year, and he's just dominating already.
Sherman all season has allowed 227 yards and one touchdown. That was through the regular season. He had 3 interceptions. Quarterback ratings against Sherman, 36.4. Your quarterback rating for an incomplete pass is 39.6.
So you're better off to spike the ball every play than to throw it to Sherman
this season. Correct. That's correct.
Now, and you can say all these things, but every time you say these, I'm thinking, well, the Chiefs offense can counteract these things. Mahomes and Lamar Jackson, I think, are the two best scramble around the pocket, try and make something out of plays. I'll throw Aaron Rodgers in there, but at least this season, probably Lamar Jackson and Mahomes, they move around the pocket very well. And Sherman is very good in coverage. He's a cover corner. He's not exactly a man-to-man. But I don't think he's covering anybody with the speed that Tyreek Hill and Mecole Hardman have. They're two of the fastest guys in the whole league, and they're both on the Chiefs' offense. You send Hill on a go route, he's gone. Sherman's not going to catch him. That's a fact. And you said Samuel has all these big plays. Tyreek Hill is kind of the big play machine on the Chiefs, whether it's end-arounds or go routes or whatever you have it. So they have a lot of matchups there, I think.
They do, you're right, and I'll move into some Chiefs stats now. Patrick Mahomes, according to ESPN's total quarterback rating, was the second most valuable passer this year in the regular season. I assume it would be behind Lamar Jackson. Yeah. But so second most valuable passer there. Tyreek Hill averages 3.2 yards of separation from his primary defender at the time of the catch, which is tied for 10th.
Oh, my goodness. So the cornerback is 3 yards behind, probably huffing for air at that point because he's just zipped past you.
It was 3.5 in the AFC Championship game against Tennessee. So another guy who's playing better here headed into the Super Bowl than he does other times. Travis Kelce, 24 red zone targets. That was second this season. 38.9% of Kansas City goal-to-go plays went in his direction. That was the most of any player.
I mean, where else would you throw it? Their run game is not very good. Their receivers are small. You have a 250, 6'5" tight end. It makes sense to me.
Couple interesting team stats then here for Kansas City. 1,127 penalty yards in the regular season. That was the third most.
I was going to say, that seems very high.
Penalty yardage, really high.
Do you have the Niners number?
I do not have the Niners number.
I would have to guess lower, though.
I almost certainly, yeah. So that's something to watch out for Kansas City. Something I thought was interesting for Andy Reid, the head coach of the Chiefs, 8-15 win percentage. That's 22-5 following a week off.
The Big Red Tomato himself knows how to get it done after a bye week.
So we'll see what happens. Those are the stats I had, like I said, from the Washington Post. I thought those were some good ones, some unique ones that I wouldn't have found otherwise, but gives you a little extra insight into the matchup that we'll have this Sunday.
Yeah, those are good ones. I got a bunch of other good. I'm going to go with the defensive one, the more traditional ones.
Sure.
So San Fran, you said they're built and bred on defense as of this year, at least because they built and bred themselves this year. Second overall in yards per game. The Chiefs are 17th, though, which I thought would be lower. If you recall last year, they were like 29th, 30th. Like, they were low in the league.
Yeah, so they were.
Their defense is doing a lot better.
Turned it on a little bit in the second half, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they were okay in the middle. But, yeah, you said it right. The second half, they played a lot better. Niners are first in pass defense. Chiefs are eighth, so that's not too bad. Rush defense, Niners are 17th. Chiefs are 26th. So that 26 is a scary number, seeing how the Niners are second in rush offense. That does not match up very well. But Derrick Henry had 69 rush yards in the AFC Championship game, and if there's one guy you're worried about running against, you, it's probably Derrick Henry, and they were able to neutralize him. I just feel like the Niners' offense is a little bit more dynamic than Tennessee. Tennessee is more like, we know we're bigger and stronger than you. We're just going to go up the gut, whereas Niners kind of have more schemes for outside zone tackles or sweeps or whatnot. I feel like that could exploit the Chiefs.
Yeah, and I think with the Titans, Derrick Henry is a guy that they've been riding all season, and when he had good games, the Titans played well, and it opened up different options for Ryan Tannehill, a quarterback, where for the Niners, Raheem Mostert has not been lighting up the NFL all season. He had a crazy game in the NFC Championship game, but they offensively have been getting along with Jimmy Garoppolo and George Kittle.
It's
and
been
different,
a running back by committee.
It has. So it's been different guys here every week. Emmanuel Sanders joined the party halfway through the year, so there's different things going on. They haven't been relying on one guy like the Titans have been. So I think the matchups, are a little bit more difficult against the Niners.
And I got two more metrics that are kind of go with your off the wall ones.
Sure.
Starting field position. It's a big stat. You want to start in a good place. I don't have the exact yardage these teams are starting at, but the Niners have the second best starting field position. So that means they have they're the second closest team to the goal line on average when they get the ball.
Courtesy of that defense, I would
absolutely
guarantee.
The Chiefs are 10th, though, which is not too bad. The one thing I love, though, time of possession. You win the game by having the ball. The Ravens led the league this year. They had like 34 minutes a game out of the 60. The Niners were 4th. The Chiefs were 21st. They didn't even have time of possession over half the game. They were below 30 minutes. But as we saw against Houston and against Tennessee, it took them 2 minutes, and they would just zip on down the field. So they're really big boom or bust. San Francisco is more the slowly, methodically, we'll melt you down with our, what works.
Again, polar opposites, really, which is part of the reason I'm so excited for the Super Bowl, because it's basically strength against strength and weakness against weakness anytime a given unit is on the field. It's something has to give. And the other thing that I don't have any actual number for this written down, but both these teams are really good when playing from behind. The Niners have one of the best records in this season when it comes to playing from behind. And obviously, we've seen what the Chiefs have done this postseason, erasing a 24-0 deficit against the Texans and coming back from 10 down against the Titans in the AFC Championship game. So a lot of times, I think scoring first is a key. Maybe scoring first is a bad thing in the Super Bowl. I don't know.
Yeah, the only thing I think there would be to say about that is with the time of possession stat, Kansas City can't let San Francisco get out to a 10-point lead, 14-point lead, because they're not going to be able to get the ball back. They're just going to run, chip away at the clock a lot, and that's going to ruin Kansas City. On the flip side, though, I don't think San Francisco really has to worry about if they fall behind. It's more of a one-sided thing, yes. Like, yeah, Kansas City can catch up if they fall behind, but just given the way the Niners play their brand of football, I don't know if that's going to exactly happen.
Yeah, and if you're looking at the Chiefs and their come-from-behind wins, the Texans have a decent defense, but I would say better up front with a guy like J.J. Watt as opposed to in the secondary where Patrick Mahomes is going to do his damage.
And where Tyrann Mathieu moved from Houston to Kansas City this past year.
Correct, and against the Tennessee Titans, Tennessee wasn't giving up a lot of points in the postseason, but they were giving up a lot of yards, very much playing a bend-don't-break type of defense. That's not the case with the 49ers. They're giving up 252.5 yards per game, which is the best of any playoff defense. They're only allowing 15 points per game, also the best of any playoff defense. So they're not playing a bend, don't break. They're playing a don't bend and don't break type of defense, and that's a little bit of a different look than what the Chiefs have seen.
Yeah, they made Aaron Rodgers and Kirk Cousins look like Duck Hodges out there. If there's one quarterback that can do it against them, though, it's probably going to be Mahomes. I mean, we saw Lamar Jackson did it very well against the Niners in the regular season. They're similar type quarterbacks, not exactly the same, but if there's one guy you want to rely on having big plays against a tough defense, it's probably Mahomes at this point.
And, you know, for all the firepower that we're talking about on either side of the ball here, no matter what team it is, I think the difference comes down to the front lines, specifically when the Chiefs are on the field, because to me, I don't care what Richard Sherman's stats look like. The secondary for the 49ers, I don't think could win this game for them.
It won't.
I think if the Niners are going to win this game, they have to win it up front and they have to get to Mahomes. If you give Mahomes time, good coverage is going to break down eventually with the speed of the receivers, like you mentioned, with the elusiveness of Patrick Mahomes, as we've seen for 2 years now. You have to get to him. Nick Bosa has to get to him. DeForest Buckner has to get to him. Those type of guys have to get home, or it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and here, and perfectly playing off of that, strength versus strength, the Chiefs were third in sacks against this year, so they protected Mahomes pretty well. The Niners were 13th, which, you know, it's okay. It's not as good. And the Niners were 5th in sacks for, and the Chiefs were 11th in sacks for. So the Niners get to quarterbacks more, and the Chiefs protect quarterbacks better. So,
something's got to give. That's the whole story. You can sum up your Super Bowl preview with something's got to give.
And what that something will be giving is not Roger Goodell, the trophy to Tom Brady. That's the most important
Thank
part.
Goodness.
I think that's all we got to say about the preview. I'm just really excited for this Sunday's game.
I am too. I've been excited all postseason, and we've had some good games, and I expect nothing. It can't be worse than last year, right? 13-3? With the Patriots coming out on top again,
yes.
It can't be.
Last year was fine, in my opinion, but I understand
it
why.
It was all right. It was okay.
It was better than the Denver-Seattle 43-8.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed.
Anyway, that's the Super Bowl preview. Now let's take a look back on the rest of the regular season as the NFL honors were given out this weekend, as they do every year before the Super Bowl on Saturday night. So, like we do, we're going to say who we think should win, even though they probably won't. I'll let you kick it off, Matt.
To be clear, these are not predictions. We are not saying who we think will win. We're making our picks.
We're casting our votes.
So I'm going to start with some of the ones that have already been established. Executive of the Year was already determined. It went to John Lynch of the San Francisco 49ers, and I would agree with that. I think that that's a good move. The 49ers were 4-12 last year and have made the move to the Super Bowl. Obviously, the voting takes place prior to the postseason, so let's just say that they move from 4-12 to the top team in the NFC. In and of itself is a fantastic jump. The defense that he added this year was just incredible. Bosa, Greenlaw, Ford, Alexander, all new guys on the defensive side of the football
this year. Alexander I liked a lot.
I did too. Huge moves, absolutely fantastic, well done. He didn't overreact to being 4-12, and that was part of the reason that I picked this team to be a playoff team in the first place, was because despite a 4-12 record, they were very average in pretty much every statistical category, and I think it'd be easy in this win-now culture for a GM, for ownership, to say, we got to blow this thing up.
See the Browns.
We're 4-12, see the Browns. He did not do that. He waited for a healthy Jimmy Garoppolo. He added, you know, methodically to the defense, and they have $15 million in cap space. So he went out, didn't do anything crazy, brought in necessary pieces, did so affordably. There's still wiggle room in case moves needed to be made going into this coming offseason. I think he did a great job, and I agree with that choice.
I think he's a fine choice. I think it's hard to not give it to somebody with a winning record, but I'm not going to give it to somebody with a losing record. I'm going to Mike Mayock of the Oakland Raiders. They had more rookie names that I like saw week in and week out than any team in the league. They had a fantastic draft. Clelin Ferrell was drafted in the top 10, and he was probably
number four, I think.
Yeah,
right?
He was one of the weaker rookies. Because he's okay. Josh Jacobs, though, stud. Great running back. They got him in the first round late from Alabama. He had over 1,000 yards. Really, I would say a top 10 rusher in the league this season. Max Crosby, defensive end. He's better than Clelin Ferrell. He's a very good defensive end. There's this guy, Brian Baldinger. He does a lot of breakdowns on Twitter of stuff, and he was a big fan of Max Crosby. He's a really good defensive end. Foster Moreau, a fantastic tight end, had a handful of touchdowns. Hunter Renfrow, the guy we saw for about 10 years at Clemson, he was making a name with Derek Carr. So they made a lot of good draft picks. Like you said, they didn't go out and go crazy. They're slowly, methodically adding to their team. And, I mean, they gave Gruden 10 years, so...
They've got a relatively big window to work with based on that. They have a huge window.
And, I mean, they got better. They were 7-9 this year. They went from 3-13 to 7-9. They're becoming a better team, and I think he made some good signings, too. Ty Williams at receiver, not too bad. Trent Brown on the offensive line. LaMarcus Joyner mixed in some good veterans with all these young guys they're adding. Kept Carr there, still has faith in Gruden. Yeah, it's kind of Gruden's team, but Mayock is technically the GM, so I'm going to give it to him.
No, I think that's a good pick. I mean, again, we're in such a win-now culture that those types of things go underrated. And I think, like I said, I like John Lynch because of the way he went about things. But certainly, if you're looking at a longer-term game, that's a really good year for Oakland. And I don't know that after the whole Antonio Brown saga, anyone really expected them to be relevant.
They rebounded well from it.
And you're right, they did. Going to coach of the year, I'm going to again agree with the decision that was made and go with John Harbaugh of the Baltimore Ravens, partially because I personally had very low expectations for the Ravens. Didn't expect them to be a playoff team. I think I had them at third in the AFC North, and they came out as number one in the NFL. 14-2 record, really good. 12 straight wins to end the season. So you start 2-2. You make your adjustments as you go. That's the sign of good coaching. Obviously, Lamar Jackson, credit goes to him for what he was able to do, but credit also goes to John Harbaugh for, you know, helping to shape that, because I think a lot of people, myself included, had low expectations for Lamar Jackson coming in. And of course, how lethal was the offense in general, but especially on the ground where they set a record for rush yards by a team in a season. I think especially given what happened in the offseason, they lost a lot of guys. They did well to replace those guys, but I think John Harbaugh really deserves a lot of credit for the work that he did this year with Baltimore.
So John Harbaugh definitely revolutionized their offense, changed it to a way that they can work with what they have, and I hate him, so I'm not going to pick him. I was going to pick Matt LaFleur from the Packers.
That'd be a good one.
But I was like, well, I'm not going to, though, because Kyle Shanahan beat him in the regular season, and Kyle Shanahan has a 13-3 team, and Kyle Shanahan took a team that was 4-12 last year now to the Super Bowl, and those Niners are doing really well, and Kyle Shanahan had to coach them well because they did not have any super big players like Lamar Jackson, or Aaron Rodgers. They didn't have any of these outstanding individual talents that could lead their team. They're a well-rounded team because they're coached very well offensively, defensively. Their defensive coordinator, Robert Salah, should be a head coach somewhere. He's not. Teams are stupid. Kyle Shanahan, though, good for him. He also, a really fun fact about him, he was in Cleveland as the offensive coordinator. He resigned because they wanted to move forward with Johnny Manziel. Good for Kyle Shanahan for resigning.
Honestly.
He made the right decision. He's in a great position now. A good young coach that hopefully won't suffer the same fate that Sean McVay suffered this year.
That was a very good pick. I like Matt LaFleur as well. The reason I considered picking him was because in Green Bay, Mike McCarthy had to go, and we've talked about the change of scenery for him and the change of dynamic in Green Bay. And so part of the reason I wanted to pick him or consider picking him was because I think he's not single-handedly, but primarily responsible for that turnaround.
No, I agree with you.
Because of the need to change a coach. Also worth noting, Brian Flores in Miami, I think, is one that I've seen get some attention.
I think it should.
Rightfully so. I sat here on the show and said they'd go
0-16. Paper bags. Put them on your faces.
I didn't go that far. They went 5-11, though. And for a team that sold, and looked at next year, he certainly found a way to make the best out of a bad situation this year. So
they don't have talent.
He will not win, nor should he win, I don't think, with some of these other coaches that we've already mentioned, but he's certainly worth at least having in the conversation.
He won in Foxborough Week 17. There's no greater reward he can get this season.
That's true. That's a good point. Let's go to Comeback Player of the Year. Typically, I think these players are players that come back from injury, but I chose not to go that route. I chose to go with Ryan Tannehill, who starting quarterback for the Dolphins for quite a number of years, gets traded with a sixth-round pick in exchange for a fourth and a seventh.
Yeah, that was stupid.
Not only did they give up on him, but they also traded him for peanuts, which is kind of a slap to the face if you're Ryan Tannehill. He sits on the bench in Tennessee, finally comes in, goes 7-3, 22 touchdowns, 6 interceptions on the season, 70% of passes he completed, which is a really, really good number at 70%. And of course, he gets them to the playoffs, and this doesn't get factored in, but in the playoffs, he takes them to the AFC title game. I mean, he really turn the season around Absolutely. For the Titans and turn his career around, really. I mean, he's going to be, I imagine, a long-term fit there with the Titans after, at this time last year, you were kind of wondering what the next move was for him. So he very quickly went from bust to solidified starter. And I think for comeback player of the year, he's a good pick.
He led the league in QBR too. I don't know if you hit on that.
I did not.
Which is impressive, seeing how he didn't even play every game. And that's a good pick. He was very efficient. And Mariota was always, well, what were we going to do with him? Well, now we have Tannehill, so we don't have to worry about it. I went the more traditional route, though. I chose a guy who got injured last year, blew out his knee, and came back with vengeance. It's Cooper Kupp, the receiver for the Rams.
It's a good one.
He missed half of last season after he tore his ACL about halfway through the season. So he comes back this year, plays an entire 16-game schedule. Phenomenal. 94 catches, really good. 1,161 yards, tremendous. 10 touchdowns. All of these things are stats you'd expect a number one receiver to have. And I don't know if LA really has a number one receiver. Brandon Cooks, I think most people would probably consider to be the number one, but the way they played this year, it's between him, Robert Woods, and Cooper Kupp. Kupp is a slot receiver, so it's not like he's getting all the super big targets, but he got enough. He did very well. And to blow out your knee like he did in the comeback, I mean, he's a speedy guy still, and receivers, they run all up and down the field. Like, it's not like he's just blocking short stints. No, he's zipping up and down left and right, so big comeback for him. I got him as my comeback player of the year.
It's a good pick. I like that one. Let's go to the rookies of the year. First, on the defensive side of the football, I'm going with, from the San Francisco 49ers, Nick Bosa. We talked about this earlier today. Kind of forgot he was a rookie. He played so well this year. Just seemed like he fit right in, like he'd been doing it for years.
Well, his brother's been around for a few years, so he has too.
It's not the case, though. He had 9 sacks. He had an interception, 16 tackles for loss, and a forced fumble on the year. But I almost feel like those stats don't do him justice, because seemed like every time he was on the field, he was chasing quarterbacks around and making big plays and at least blowing up the play if he wasn't the one actually recording the stat for the tackle or the sack or whatever. Really good year for him. I mean, I think if you can be a rookie and disguise that and make it look like you've been doing it for years, you're doing something right. So Nick Bosa is my choice there.
He's my choice as well. I mean, you said it. I don't know if you said 25 quarterback hits too, which is, ouch. That's a lot of hits. He's a big, strong guy. He's getting there fast. Number 2 overall pick. I don't know if the Cardinals are upset they didn't have him, but they're probably fine with Murray. It probably worked out for the Niners. They got him. He's
very well.
He's really good. He's going to be good for a number of years too. He's clearly a guy that deserves this reward, and in a few years might be talking about him as defensive player of the year. Moving on to the offensive side of the ball, though, I'm going to go to the Oakland Raiders, the team I've been so highly praising tonight, and it's running back Josh Jacobs. He had 1,150 yards on the ground in 7 touchdowns, and that was in 13 games. He missed 3 games with injury, too, so he could have very well had 1,400 yards, maybe 8 or 9 touchdowns if he kept up his pace. Really just a great rookie campaign, and he was a guy I'm like, why the heck did the Raiders draft him in the first round? You know, you can get running backs later, and he wasn't exactly a guy that stood out at Alabama. I'm wrong. They found a guy that fits their team very well, complements Derek Carr very well.
He was my choice as well. A.J. Brown from the Titans was one that I considered.
I wanted to.
But I think Jacobs is the better option. You talked about what he did on the ground. He also added 20 catches for 166 yards in the passing game. I mean, again, I think it comes back to, in Oakland, I didn't have high expectations for him, didn't have high expectations for that team, that offense, and they kind of came out and proved us wrong, and he certainly played his role in that. And so, yeah, I agree, Josh Jacobs for Offensive Rookie of the Year.
All right, let's move to Offensive and Defensive Player of the Year. I'll start on the defensive side since you did before. I'm going to pick a dark horse candidate, one that people are not talking about enough. I brought them up earlier, too. It's the Arizona Cardinals. It's Chandler Jones, defensive end. 19 sacks on the year. I haven't heard about that very much. 19 is a ridiculously high number to have. 8 forced fumbles, 3 fumble recoveries, 11 tackles for loss, 26 quarterback hits. The Cardinals don't have very many pieces. They have Kyler Murray, they have Patrick Peterson, they have Chandler Jones. He was good when he played in New England, too. And he got moved to Arizona, you know, as players do, it's whatever. And he did very well, and people aren't talking about him enough, probably because the Cardinals just didn't have a great season overall. But he was a big playmaker for their team. 19 sacks, that's a really good number. If Aaron Donald had 19 sacks, people would be like, oh, defensive player of the year easily already. Yeah, throw it to him. T.J. Watt had less sacks than that, and people are throwing him into the conversation more than Chandler Jones, and I just don't think that's fair.
Well, I'm going to address that, I suppose, because I'm going to go with T.J. Watt. And here's the reason that I'm going with T.J. Watt. Statistically, in a lot of categories, there are guys who did it better than he did in terms of interceptions. He had a couple. Other guys had more, had six, if you're looking at like a Gilmore in
Stephon
New England.
Gilmore, yes.
Yeah. If you look at sacks, Chandler Jones had more. Shaq Barrett, who absolutely should also be in this conversation, had 19 and a half sacks. He's not even like on people's radar.
No, he should be.
Six forced fumbles to go with that as well. He should be on somebody's radar. He would have been my second choice behind TJ. But getting back to TJ, he didn't have as many sacks. He didn't have as many interceptions. He did have as many forced fumbles as Chandler Jones, and they tied with eight for the most in the NFL. But the reason that I went with TJ is because nobody had a season like him in terms of doing a little bit of everything. If you look at the guys that are sack leaders, they don't have – Shaq Barrett has an interception. Chandler Jones does not. Forced fumbles are there, but like I said, they are for TJ too. If you look at a guy who has six interceptions, who has a pick six, they don't have the sacks. Like TJ Watt just was so versatile that I think if you look at a cornerback and say that, oh, well, they did it, you know, this well – you can look at another one and say, well, they were right there too. And I think the same thing with Chandler Jones. You make a very great point. He absolutely would deserve it. Shaq Barrett does too. Very similar stat lines for those guys on the year. TJ Watt has a stat line that's unique to him. No one else did everything as well. He may not have the sacks or the interceptions that one guy has to be better than everybody else, but across the board, I think he was the most complete defensive player, and so that's why TJ Watt would be my choice.
He was probably more balanced. Chandler Jones had two games where he had four sacks in each game, so
that's insane.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. One of them was against Seattle too, so I mean he's doing it against good competition. But yeah, Watt seemed like he showed up every single week, was excellent every single week. Yeah, Gilmore, I don't know.
Stephon Gilmore almost sounds like he's the front runner, and I don't know that he should be.
I would give it to Marcus Peters before I would give it to Gilmore, but I'm not going to give it to him either. I would give it to Barrett or Watt or Jones. Watt would be second on my list, I think, but whatever.
There's a lot of good guys to choose from here at this point.
No Khalil Mack, no Aaron Donalds, and there shouldn't be. There's better guys this year. Moving to the offensive player of the year side, I'm not going to pick the same guy I picked for MVP because that's no fun. We have two different awards, so let's give it to two different people. The best offensive player was Michael Thomas, receiver for the Saints. 149 receptions, set a record for the entire league. Overall, led the league, obviously. 725 yards receiving, led the league. 9 touchdowns. He was a terror. His nickname is You Can't Guard Mike. Well, obviously not, and no cornerback in the league found out a way to cover him. He was Drew Brees' bread and butter, the guy he threw it to when he needed most. He was just always dominant, so good a receiver this year. He's been a good receiver for a number of years. People are finally giving him the credit he deserves. He's my offensive player of the year.
I'm really glad that you picked him because I feel like there are two guys that are equally deserving to win this award, and I picked the other one, which is good. That means that we get to recognize them both. Christian McCaffrey was absolutely phenomenal this year. He was the third player in NFL history to go 1,000 yards rushing and 1,000 yards receiving. He had 1,387 on the ground. He had 1,005 receiving. He had 116 catches as a running back. He broke his own record for receptions by a running back. 116. If a receiver gets 100 catches, it's a really good year. A running back had 116 catches, 1,000 and 1,000, 19 total touchdowns. I had a hard time picking between these two because they both are setting records. They're both doing incredible things, but like I said, glad that you picked Michael Thomas and that I have Christian McCaffrey because they're both
deserving.
Are very deserving. So Christian McCaffrey is my choice.
The only difference, I think, is on the Saints, there's a few more options. Christian McCaffrey
was the Panthers.
He is the Carolina Panthers. Was and is. I don't know what they got going for him.
You're right.
And I think we're going to probably agree on MVP, as everybody in the entirety of the National Football League should, and it's Lamar Jackson, quarterback, running back, receiver, defensive end, cornerback. He is so good, he can just probably play everything. He is so versatile. So in the air, he had 3,127 yards, which is
fine.
It's okay.
It's nothing special.
It's not a lot. The 36 touchdowns, though, based on that very stat, good. Excellent. I've never seen a guy have that many touchdowns based on 3,000 yards. Usually, you'd probably be in the 25 touchdown range at most at that point. 36 led the league. Only 6 interceptions, too. 3 of them came in one game against the Steelers, so he was very efficient. And then if you take away his arm, he still has 2 great legs, 1,206 yards on the ground. That was in the top 10 in the league, 7 rushing touchdowns. He was a better running back than majority of the league had, and he could also throw the ball. The true dynamic two-way player or dual-threat player that people thought couldn't succeed. He did what Michael Vick did like 15 years ago, but better.
And honestly, it's kind of fun to watch. It's fun to see a guy who... It brings such a different style. I mean, when you think about the best quarterbacks in the league now and in the last few years, you think of guys who aren't necessarily that mobile.
Pocket passers.
Aaron Rodgers was at one point, not so much now. Drew Brees never really was. Peyton Manning never was. Tom Brady never was. It's a lot of your prototypical passers. And Lamar Jackson brings a different element to it. And for me, MVP, I think in all sports, it's, and I probably said this before on the show, it's basically goes to the best player, but most valuable is in there for a reason. Most valuable to your team. And when he leads the Baltimore Ravens to a 14-2 record, 13 as the starter, obviously he sat out week 17, that's being valuable. And I mean, when you look at the other guys on that roster, they were guys that played well on both sides of the ball, but no earth-shattering numbers. I mean, Lamar Jackson is what gave everybody headaches. He could throw the ball, he could run the ball, help the Ravens set a single season rushing record. I mean, really, nobody had any answer for him all season, and if it doesn't get more valuable to your team than that, I don't know what does.
No, and I think there's three players in the league that, right now, that are just electrifying. Lamar Jackson, Patrick Mahomes, and Saquon Barkley. You see those guys in the field, they're just moving at different speed. They're just doing things differently in the same game of football that everybody else is playing. They're just at a whole other level. Like, Jackson takes the ball, he can, you know, pretend like he's going to run, and then he jukes around people. Like, so many good videos. It's just, he's fun to watch. You're right. It's really good to see him. That's probably all we got to say about the honors, huh?
That's what I got.
Oh, man. We are getting really far ahead of ourselves, but that's okay, though. That's what this is all about. We're going to take a break, slow things down a little bit, calm down. When we get back, though, got some more good news. Stay tuned.
Do you wanna make it better?
Welcome back, Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris.
Did you just introduce us?
He said I was going to take the lead.
Holy cow. All right, go ahead. You're excited. Go for it.
He told me to take the lead. I'm just grabbing it by the reins.
Wow, that's the first. I don't think you've ever done that.
No, yeah. It's not. Anyway,
off guard.
Football, we finished it. Baseball, it's not starting for 2 months. But boy, is there a lot of good stuff to talk about. First, we're going to hit on some signings and trades that happened pretty much from December through January that we missed while we were on break. Then we're going to get to the more recent stuff. So I'm going to start with the, I guess, chronological order. We'll go back to right after we went to break. Texas acquired their ace. Corey Kluber got traded from the Indians to the Rangers. I don't know what they got in return, but really, who cares? Because it doesn't make a difference anyway this year. Indians not really in a good position. Texas gets the guy that they need to lead their staff, and they really look like they're revamping themselves a lot this year. We'll see what it does, but that was a good move. White Sox, they made a lot of moves we talked about before we went to break. Chicago added Dallas Keuchel, 3 years, $55 million. Once again, basically another good starter. You just want to throw in the rotation, say, all right, we got another decent guy that knows how to win. Sound signing for them. Toronto, this is a little bit interesting to me, though. They signed pitcher Hyun-Jin Ryu, 4 years, $80 million. He came from the Dodgers this past season. I don't see them as a team ready to compete right now. And Ryu is a guy who clearly has more years behind him than ahead of him. But he's still good, and if Toronto maybe thinks they can make some noise, I guess it's fine. I don't know. They got a lot of young guys. They got a lot of stuff to figure out. Minnesota, a team that does not have a lot to figure out. They just say, we like to hit home runs. We're going to hit some more. Bringer of rain, Josh Donaldson, has signed a four-year, $94 million deal. Huge money. He's looking to add about 35 home runs to Target Field. Sure, why not? He was good in Toronto. He's good in the AL. He was good with Atlanta last year. It's a good signing for Minnesota, who's looking to carry on into what they did last year into this year. Atlanta is another team that likes to hit the ball a ton. They signed Marcell Ozuna, outfielder, 1 year, $18 million. That's a big deal for a guy who had a little bit of a down year last year with the Cardinals. Not too bad, but he hits the ball really well. Atlanta had a lot of offensive firepower last year, should have more this year. And most recently, Reds signed third base outfielder Nick Castellanos, 4 years, $64 million. And this is a great signing for them. They were lacking some offensive firepower. The pitching's been there. They've made a lot of transitions this year. They're looking to be a real threat, and this is a good move for them.
Yeah, we've already kind of talked about the Reds making some moves here, and this one not only is good for them, but anytime you can steal somebody from within the division,
from the Cubs,
is also going to benefit you greatly. The Chicago White Sox, you talked about making some moves. Gio Gonzalez also heads there.
Some veteran pitchers.
A veteran pitcher, only a $4.5 million contract. Nothing huge, but for that price, I think that's a very good add. Let's see what else. Oh yeah, the Hyun-Jin Ryu one's interesting.
It's weird.
You talked about Toronto not being ready to compete. Certainly not in that division. I mean, the Yankees have to have that thing on lock. The Red Sox are only a couple years removed from a World Series.
The Rays
granted,
are great.
They're going through some stuff, but they're there. You're right. The Rays are there as well. I mean, Toronto very easily could make some improvements and still be the fourth best team in that division.
They could very well have 82 wins.
And be the fourth best team in that division.
Right.
So, yeah, I get where you're what you're saying there. Cole Calhoun went to Arizona, 2 years, $14 million.
That was good. I like
which
that
is one. A nice addition given the next move that we're going to talk about that Arizona made
did
there.
Did we talk about Mad Bum going there before?
I don't know if we did or not, but he's there as well now.
Yeah.
So
we'll lump it in.
The Diamondbacks are trying to make some strides out in the West. I think those are the big ones. You hit on most of them. I think you're seeing a theme, though. It doesn't feel like things are spread out. It feels like there are a couple teams making big moves, and then there are some teams that are just kind of hanging out. And I think you're going to see some shifts come once the regular season starts in Major League Baseball.
And one team that is hanging out is a lot closer to home, and it's the Pittsburgh Pirates. And they sent the only guy making double-digit salary numbers, Starling Marte, across two different time zones. They said, you like hot, dry weather? Well, go stick yourself in Arizona for a few months. You're going to be their new center fielder. And what the Pirates get in return for him? Two more prospects. Boy, don't we hear this all the time. Yeah, trade the good guys for prospects. Albeit, it works out sometimes. Brian Reynolds from the McCutcheon deal was fine. The crap we got from the Cole deal, though. Joe Musgrove, Colin Moran. What, these are guys you can put on posters outside the stadium and say, yeah, come on, come see these guys. Who's that guy? Oh, you got a red beard, though. He's interesting. No, I mean, and they're fine ball players. But this is not the way. You're not going to win games. You're not going to win games this way. And yes, I understand there's a whole new regime here and they got to do their whole thing. You know, it's a long process. They have a whole new staff, a whole new GM. But my God, how many times can you rebuild in my lifetime? I'm 21 and the Pirates have taken off 5 years from my life just from having been so putrid for so long. Their payroll to open the season will be $43 million on the, or 41 is going to be on the books. We got $6.5 million going to some guy in jail for liking underage people, and $1.5 million is still going to Marte out to Arizona just to, I don't know, grievances for playing two time zones away. I don't know why we're paying him still. It's despicable. It's the third worst payroll in the entire league. I don't care. They're not going to be good this year. They're not going to win a lot. That's fine. Do something to make me want to go see them. Nothing they've done. They signed Guillermo Heredia. He's a bum center fielder that is no better than any of the other bums that we could throw out there. And, you know, these guys are fine. They're in the MLB. That's whatever. I'm not here to, oh, you tried. No, this is the MLB. You came to win a World Series. You don't come to do bogus giveaways at the ballpark. You put a team out there that people enjoy and feel proud to watch. And quite frankly, I feel neither of the two.
I don't have a whole lot to add to that. You did a pretty good job. This MLB segment is probably one of the most excited I think I've ever seen you. That NASCAR. So the Pirates are giving NASCAR a run for their money, but not in a good way.
Do something.
The prospects, for what it's worth, that they got are both top 20 prospects. Guys that honestly will probably contribute sooner than later, given the state of our
roster. Throw them out there. Can't be any worse than we got.
The $43 million payroll is what really gets me. If you want to go into a rebuild and you want to move a guy like Starling Marte, that's fine. But at $43 million, you have to sign somebody. You have to sign somebody, and there's time for them to sign somebody. I don't think that $43 million is going to be what their payroll is on opening day.
I hope not.
But you've got to do something. I'm fine with the trade. I think we knew Starling Marte was on the way out.
I think
that was pretty much a foregone conclusion. I don't like getting prospects back, but if these guys are almost MLB-ready prospects, then by all means, add them to the group of guys that made their debuts last year. It can be a young team, that's fine, but there's got to be some sort of direction. There's got to be some type of veteran presence.
Who is the veteran on the team?
Polanco? Probably, right? It's got to be Polanco,
and
doesn't
it? He's been around 7 years?
Yeah, not that long.
8 years, maybe?
I think I saw that Marte was the last member of the 2013 wildcard winning team.
I entirely believe it.
Polanco came on the next year, so he's been around since 14.
And Marte deserves to play for a contender.
He's a very
good player.
And Josh Bell's here. Josh Bell, for now, is still going to do good things.
And that's the way it works. It's always for now.
The Pirates have good pieces. And I made a bold prediction earlier that they would make the playoffs. And that was probably the boldest prediction I've ever made on the show, if not one of the most bold predictions I've ever made on the show. But they still have an opportunity to make something happen. They just have to actually go out and use some of this money. And obviously we see a move like this and assume nothing is going to come of it, because in the past nothing has come of it. With a new GM, I would like to think maybe that'll be different.
And you see, like on all those guys that we rattled off earlier, you know, all those teams I said, Atlanta is probably a lock for the postseason, maybe. None of them are locks for the postseason. Texas by no means is. Chicago, no. Toronto, certainly not. Cincinnati looks good, but that's on paper. We said the same thing about Philadelphia last year. Regardless, they're trying. They're trying hard. It's funny. I saw, I'm going to relate to NFL because why not? Carson Palmer. He was a good quarterback. Did you see the one? You know,
I did.
He was a good quarterback for the Bengals for a number of years when they were good but never good enough. He always felt like they were never trying to go that extra step to win the Super Bowl. Like, you need to do a lot. We talked about the Niners. They did a lot this year to get to where they are. You can't just, you know, kind of coast by with what you got. You got to go out and get it. And for what it's worth, the Pirates are doing none of it.
Side note here on MLB, just to wrap up the segment, Dusty Baker is the new manager of the Houston Astros.
I like it a lot.
We both like that sign.
No, many people don't, but I think he brings success to teams even though he's 70. Yeah, analytics aside, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of analytics department in Houston this year.
And yeah, you know what? If you're Houston, take what you can get. At least you have a manager. At least you had somebody who wanted to step into your mess. Moving on to the NHL, we're going to hit this quick before we wrap up the show. Alex Ovechkin is obviously not a popular man in Pittsburgh, but it's impossible to not recognize what he's doing. Just tonight, he scored goal number 693 of his career. That passes Steve Yzerman for ninth place on the NHL's all-time goal-scoring list. He is one behind Mark Messier, so he will move into eighth maybe this weekend when they play the Penguins.
Sure.
693 goals in 1,134 games. That's about 0.6 goals per game. If he keeps up that pace, it would take him about 1,466 games to catch Wayne Gretzky. That's about, for first all time, for the most in NHL history, that's about four more seasons. That is not impossible.
I would say it's more doable than impossible.
To say that he could catch Wayne Gretzky, just saying it sounds wrong, sounds impossible. The fact that he could keep up his current pace and do it in 4 years, very doable. And I would guess he has more than 4 years in him, so there's wiggle room there.
Oh, yeah. We are witnessing greatness. I mean, Crosby is a generational player. Ovechkin might be the best scorer of all time.
He very well may be the best goal scorer of all time.
This year alone, he's passed Luke Robitaille, Teemu Selanne, Mario Lemieux, Steve Yzerman. These are Hall of Famers. These are legends. These are the people that the sport raised and got big on. And he's just knocking by these guys left and right like they're, you know, in the 20s or something. I mean, he is insane. He's 201 now behind Gretzky's all-time record. And he's been scoring about 50 goals a year for like the last 5 years. It's entirely possible he gets... He could hit 60 this year. That's not
absolutely.
It's not out of the realm of possibility. I mean, he's at what? He's on 35 on the season right now. And they're at game about 50, 55.
Give or take, yeah.
Something like that. So, I mean, 50 I think is easy this season. 60 within the realm of possibility. But he's 34 right now. He can play four more years and be perfectly fine. He can play till he's 38. I mean, he's not a guy who's had injury history. I would say it's more likely that he breaks it than he doesn't at this point.
I will never say that Alex Ovechkin is the best player in the NHL because he's not. There are several guys that are overall better players, more well-rounded than
Crosby,
he is.
David, Crosby, Kane, Kucherov.
However, when it comes to goal scoring, I have never seen anybody in my lifetime that can do what he does. And with the way he's going right now, there may never have been anybody who did it the way he does. Goal scoring is his specialty, and he does it very well. And I agree that I think it's very possible he catches Gretzky. Assuming he doesn't, the person in second place is Gordie Howe. He has 801 goals, much more attainable than Gretzky's 894. Yeah. I don't know, barring a sudden shocking retirement or a devastating injury, I don't see any way that Alex Ovechkin is not second place all time when he retires.
He's scoring at an elite level still. There's no retirement in sight for a guy who is playing as good today as he did 10 years ago. Credit to him. I don't like the guy, but
it's hard to watch when he lights up a team that you prefer to have win, but it's something to witness for sure.
Yeah. Go ahead. You can take the lead with quick picks.
All right. Lead is back to me. That's more like what we're used to.
All right.
To quick picks we go. Flames and Oilers playing a home and home in the coming week. I'm going to go with a split. These are two teams that are in the very contentious Pacific Division. They've had some not so kind things going on between one another in recent games. I think it'll be two very even games played. I think they'll each take one.
I'm going to take the Flames in both of these games. Cassian's coming off his suspension. He also just got paid, too, like $3.5 million annual average value for like 4 years. Some really random deal. I don't care. The Oilers are not real. The Flames are decent enough. I think they're mad at what Cassian did. I think they're going to win both these games. Pens at Caps this weekend. First of four meetings to be had this season still. This will decide the division. And I got the Caps taking this one. It's at home. Ovechkin's doing great things. Like you said, he's probably going to pass Messier or tie him this weekend or whatever against us. And that wouldn't surprise me, so I got the Caps.
I'm going to go Penguins. Injuries have kind of been their issue all year, but they're rested with the All-Star game, giving them some time off. Their bye week was here. And this looks like the type of team that gave the Capitals fits in recent postseasons. I like the way the Penguins look. Panthers and Blue Jackets, I'm going with the Panthers. I think they're hands down a more talented team. Columbus was playing really well before the All-Star game, but I think that's a pretty good momentum killer, so I'll go with Florida.
This is a revenge game for Tortorella. He's lost Bobrovsky in the offseason for $70 million, and Bobrovsky has done nothing but show why he's not worth that and why Tortorella made the right decision to not have him come back. I'm going to go with the Blue Jackets. I can't stand them, and I guess the theme tonight is picking teams I don't want to win. Either way, I got Columbus. To the NBA, where it sounds like we're going to make a lot of the same teams as we picked last week, but I assure you they're just playing each other as opposed to the games they played last week. Jazz at Nuggets. I got the Nuggets in this one. They're playing at home. Home court advantage is so important in the NBA. The Jazz have been good recently, but I think the Nuggets kind of want the division back. I got Denver.
I'm going to go with the Jazz. Everything statistically is so close between these two teams. I'm just going to go with the team that's playing better right now. The Jazz are 8-2 in their last 10, so I'm taking Utah. Mavericks at Rockets. Going back to who's hotter, I'm going with the Mavericks. The Houston Rockets are 4-6 in their last 10. The Mavericks are 16-6 on the road this year. I'll go with Dallas.
I'm going to go with Houston again because, well, they failed me last week. So, come on, Houston, you got to do well for me this week. You got to make my prediction come true. I don't know. I'm grasping at straws here. The Rockets. 76ers at Heat in another revenge game, this time for Jimmy Butler. left the Sixers in the offseason, went to the Heat, doing a lot of good things in South Beach, and will continue to do a lot of good things as they will knock the pants off the Sixers. I got the Heat in this one by a landslide.
I have the Heat as well, and I have two stats to back it up. Miami 21-3 at home, Philadelphia 9-15 on the road. Close case for me. To the Super Bowl we go, the Chiefs and the 49ers, the big game, and I'm going with San Francisco. The defense, I think, is going to get the job done. They have a solid offense. They can take care of business. The rush attack has been what seems to be successful this postseason, as well as the defense. They have what they need. There's some experience on that team. I've got the 49ers.
The way the Chiefs played before the Patriots game made me think this is a team that's going to win the Super Bowl. The fact that they're in the Super Bowl doesn't sway my opinion at all. Chiefs, 35-29. You heard it here first.
I'll go 27-22 for the Niners.
All right.
To bold predictions we go, and I'm going to stick with the Super Bowl. My Super Bowl MVP from the San Francisco 49ers defense will be Nick Bosa, the rookie, defensive rookie of the year, as we said. I think if the 49ers are going to win this game, it has to be somebody up front and getting the job done for them. It's not going to be somebody in the secondary that wins the game. It's going to be somebody getting to Patrick Mahomes. Bosa's got 9 sacks on the year, 3 in the postseason. He has to get home, and I think he will.
I don't think he's going to get to Mahomes. Obviously, I'm not going to pick him to win the MVP because I'm picking the Chiefs anyway. I'm going to go on the offensive side of the ball, and yes, Mahomes is great, but Travis Kelce was one of the main reasons they came back against the Texans, and Travis Kelce will be the main reason they win the Super Bowl. He is just a dominant force on offense. Yes, Mahomes is the best player on the offense, but the way Kelce's been playing recently, you can't guard him. You can't defend him. You can hold him. You can do what you want, but I don't think the Niners have the size to compete with him. I think he will take away the MVP honors.
To the NBA, we talked about the tragic loss of Kobe Bryant. I think his number 24 is going to be retired league-wide.
I think that's it. Yeah.
I don't know how soon that'll happen, but we've already seen Mark Cuban of the Mavericks say that no Mavericks player will ever wear number 24 again. Obviously, Kobe wore 8 for half of his career, so you could really pick which number, I suppose, but I think 24 is the one that will be retired out of paying respect for him and just what he did for the NBA. I think that 24 is probably done in the NBA.
Some players are changing their numbers, too, from 24 as well.
Or I've seen
off
that,
of
yeah.
8. They're doing a lot of things about it. That's a good one. In the NBA, similar vein, Milwaukee Bucks, they're ridiculous. They're 41-6. They scored 88 points in the first half the other night against the Wizards en route to 151-131 victory. They just can't lose. I don't think they're going to break the Warriors' record of 73-9. But I think they can hit 70 wins, though. I think they have the talent. They're well-rounded. I mean, that game I said that they scored 151, Giannis didn't even play in. And he is the reigning MVP and very well could be MVP again this season. The Bucks are for real. They're a threat. 70 wins, well within their realm.
I like it. To the NHL for the last one. I think there's going to be 3 or more 50-goal scorers for the first time since the 09-10 season.
Do you know who they were that year by chance?
Ooh, I don't. When you give yours, I'll look it up.
Okay.
But right now you've got Pastrnak coming into tonight at 37. Auston Matthews has 35. Ovechkin had 34. Obviously, he scored another one tonight. Nathan MacKinnon has 30. You've got all these guys that are just lighting the lamp like crazy, and you just don't see it that often, but I think we're going to have 3 of them this year.
Yeah, it's like they got a light switch built into their stick. I like it, though. It's a good one. I'm going to stay in basketball, but move to the college side of things. San Diego State, they're 21-0. Last undefeated team in college basketball, ranked 4th still. I think they're going to win their next 5 games, move on to 26-0 before they lose to UNLV. They played UNLV recently. It was a close game. They had to come back. They only won by, I think, 4 or 5. So I think it's possible that they will be able to win a few more, but the next time they see the running Rebels, they'll get knocked off. You got that stat for me?
2009-2010.
Wait, can I guess?
Sure. 3 guys.
Stamkos.
Yes.
Ovechkin.
Yes.
Sedin?
No. Crosby. Tied. That was the year that him and Stamkos
51.
Shared the Rocket Richard at 51.
Yep.
Alex Ovechkin had 50. This year is going to happen again.
I believe it, though. It's good.
That is all the time that we have for tonight. Thank you to everybody for tuning in. We're excited to get going here this semester with some good stuff. We'll be back with some Super Bowl recaps next week. Until then, good night, everybody.